Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
It's not quite an emergency podcast, actually. It's the first time things have returned to slight amounts of normality. I think as we really need to talk about this astonishing fact of the number of people who've signed up to vote as registered supporters. So it's, what, 180,000?
185,000.
And at 25 quid a pop, that is nearly £5 million, right?
Someone
can check my maths if they want to. But actually, for a Labour Party that has got not a big cash flow issue because it spent so much on the referendum and it's not attracting big donors, that is good news.
I mean, that it basically means that they have spent only £500,000 on the referendum, as it were. They have all but wiped out their referendum spend.
Yeah, so that's nice. And actually, they probably have enough money to vet all those people. I think, as someone put it, to type all their names into Google plus SWP or Greens or whatever.
The other slight interesting thing about all of the money is last time a lot of party staffers accepted that they had to do unpaid overtime because someone had to vet it and there was no money. The interesting thing is, of course, now there is money. You kind of wonder whether a lot more people can go, do you know what? Actually, I do want the overtime, or we are going to get pizza every day, or et cetera, et cetera.
So Paul Waugh of the Huffington Post reports, and he had to update and correct this, 60-40 from sampling, 60% in favour of Corbyn, but 40% against. Now, if you think about the fact that registered supporters last time were 80%, like
89%.
Overwhelmingly in support of Corbyn, then certainly there has been either you say there's been a cooling or there's been a concerted effort and campaign to try and sign up people who want to sign up specifically to vote against him. That's not likely to... I don't think Owen Smith should be measuring up the curtains in Labour's new HQ on Southside. But at the moment, I don't know what you think.
I think so. A couple of points. There will be a lot of claims about what percentages of the members are. Last time the Labour leadership did a consultation of the members, they literally pulled the first 1,000 responses, decided those must be representative, and kind of went on from there. The Labour Party is not really built for... I mean, obviously, they now do have... You know, they could use some of this money to get proper software for it. They don't know for certain what the political composition of these people are, partly because there is... a feeling, you can call it paranoia if you wish, on both sides. I have had people say to me, I've joined to vote for Corbyn, but I didn't put it because I'm going to get purged. And you've had people saying, I joined to vote against Corbyn, and I didn't put it because I'm going to get purged. I mean, in reality, last time, of a total electorate of 100,000 registered supporters, 3,000 people were purged for, standing for other parties, being on the national executive or the national health executive.
I mean, the bar was pretty high, wasn't it?
The bar was fairly high. But, there is a perception on both sides that if you put why you're really there, you may be purged. So I just wouldn't necessarily take any of that seriously. To be honest, my strong feeling is I would be astonished if the registered supporters was as good for Owen Smith as 60-40. In terms of the quality of the sort of social media offering of...
Oh, well, let's talk about the fact that Corbyn is a killer on Facebook. So I wrote my column on this week. He's got 750,000 people signed up to his personal page. I was told by someone inside Labour's digital team that in the last week, his page reached one third of all UK internet users, because it will show up and related links from people. People will share it with their friends, and two thirds of people anyway are on Facebook. Out of the people who use the internet, almost all of those people use Facebook, and lots of them will see that page. The official Labour Party page has only got, I say only, but still quite impressive, it's 500,000, but it's less than Corbyn himself. And actually, from talking So online campaigners, you know, they say the thing that something that we've noticed as well with Twitter and Facebook and the way we structure our website. People online, people like people. That was the phrase that I heard. You know, and actually they people will want to follow Jeremy Corbyn in a way that they won't want to kind of hear just from the Labour Party as an entity. In the same way that I'm sure there are lots of people who follow, you know, your Twitter feed, and they're invested in you more than they are invested in the New Statesman per se.
Well, yeah, I mean, the classic example is the Staggers, which when I was editing it has, you know, a fair whack of followers. And if you could bump up its numbers, I would appreciate that a great deal. But it has about 10,000 less than I...
As a human do.
As a human do.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's, you know, that's a problem. I mean, when someone said to me, well, look, think about all the effort that they will have put into building up the David Cameron Facebook page, and that is now essentially, not a waste of money, but they can't use that anymore. You know, this support, particularly online, is not easily transferable, you know, to institutions. And I think that's one of the interesting things. I mean, when I looked on Tuesday, Owen Smith's Facebook page had fewer than 3,000 people signed up. I suspect as he's got a bit more coverage, there will be more there. But certainly anyone else is coming from a really long way behind on the most popular social network. And actually, I think it's really, we should talk about Facebook not as a social network, but as a media company. I mean, it's how people get a huge amount of their news.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, several people on both sides of you know, left and, you know, both the Labour Party and believe that Facebook will be almost as important as, will be, you know, the second most important platform after the BBC. A long way back from the BBC, of course, but, you know, still. And, yeah, the thing I thought kind of summed up one of the reasons why my instinct is I just don't believe that Saving Labour has managed to recruit that many people were the videos urging people to sign up from Angela Eagle's now mothballed campaign and Jeremy Corbyn's. Jeremy Corbyn's had subtitles, Angela Eagle's did not.
Yeah, I think that's something that's really fascinating, is I still kind of cringe when I see people who do Facebook videos that don't have subtitles on, because you think, do you not know how many people are watching this at work and they don't have any headphones plugged into their computer and they can't play stuff over the office, you know, on speakers? But yeah, so I think that's something that actually Labour's digital offering is underappreciated. And as you say, I think you made this point during the mayoral campaign, that the targeting of, say, sort of Tamil voters with these sort of kind of strange things about how Sadiq Khan was going to steal your family jewellery, that will all happen in the next iteration via targeted ads online. So we might not see them, it'd be harder for them to surface. I mean, certainly there is a feeling among political campaigners that if you want something to get the press's attention, that you do it on Twitter, because that's where everybody in the lobby is. If you want something that targets, you know, voters and activists directly, you do it on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, someone once put it to me that there's the efficient and there's the dignified aspects of political campaigning. And the efficient bit happens on Facebook, and then there's a lot of stuff, and also in going through people's doors and through music radio, et cetera, and then there's the bits you do so the people who cover it and shape the stuff which matters appreciate what you're doing. So I know for a fact that there are certain big-name bloggers, activists and columnists who receive literature from both the main political parties that their geographical location would not necessarily... Yeah, I mean, so for example, I do not receive that much literature from any of the political parties other than the Greens in my bit of Stoke Newington. But I know of other columnists who live sort of near me who receive literature than, yeah, I mean, the Tories are not going to win Stoke Newington. What they want is that one person to go, oh, isn't this targeting they're doing very clever?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. So I think it's something that I also think is going to be a theme of the summer, is that this isn't a crude oversimplification, but I think it broadly holds true, which is that Jeremy Corbyn is really, really good at winning internal Labour elections and at campaigning to Labour activists. And that is, and not in a way that he is, unfortunately, not to people who are soft UKIPers or swing voters in Labour Tory marginals. And I think you can see that in the fact that his demeanour has perked up considerably. You know, there was a very strong anti-Owen Smith splash that was obviously, I would say, planted in the Times and the Guardian. The fact that it appeared in both suggests to me that came from a briefing from his team. I'm sure they will get in touch to deny that if they want to. But, you know, and just generally, they are better set up to run against Owen Smith than they are against Theresa May.
Yes. I mean, I think the other aspect of all that, of course, is I think, you know, one of the many problems with saving Labour as a message is, one, it doesn't convince soft Corbynites, right? If you're a soft Corbynite, and thank you, by the way, for all of you in the Labour Party, regardless of your politics, whether you are a dyed-in-the-wool Corbynite, a despairing supporter of Liz Kendall, or perhaps someone hoping for a restoration of Tony Blair even, I really appreciate your various thoughts on the state of the party, even though I have been incredibly rubbish at replying to lots of them. But what I find really striking is, if you're a soft Corbynite, you're worried about the competence, you're worried that he won't win, but you haven't looked at Angela Eagle or Owen Smith's rollout and gone, oh, they're competent. You don't think they'll win, and you're not convinced by this idea that the Labour Party needs to be saved. You think then the worst that will happen is a bad defeat. And in some ways, it feels like the mirror image of when Labour tries to fight general elections on the platform of saving the NHS.
Mm.
People like the NHS. They think it will be around when they need it. And they kind of can't be bothered to put their hand in their pocket and pay to save it in the here and now. And my instinct is that saving Labour will, yeah, do well to get as much of a share of the vote as Ed Miliband saving the NHS did in 2015, i.e. 31%.
So, which brings me kind of neatly onto to game planning what happens next, really. But I think that's something that's maybe better saved for You Ask Us. So we'll join you again after the break.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can get this episode and everything else we've done on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So Theresa May had her first Prime Minister's questions this week, and she was fairly formidable. Even veteran Prime Ministers are often incredibly nervous and anxious about the occasion. But if she was, it didn't show. It was a very assured performance. She deployed dark humour quite effectively, and left Tory MPs looking delighted and Labour MPs looking even more miserable than normal.
Yeah, so it was I guess she did have the advantage of having a full week to prepare, but it was a very polished performance of PMQs, or should that be TMQs? What was the kind of highlight of her performance from your perspective?
So there was an extended riff that she used when Jeremy Corbyn attacked her over worker insecurity, and she said, of course there are lots of unscrupulous bosses around, and I'm sure Labour MPs will be familiar with one, and he treats you badly, he changes the rules in his favour, and then, sounding remarkably uncannily like Margaret Thatcher, so leant forward and said, does this remind you of anyone? And that was so her moments of maximum confidence and authority. She played on Labour divisions quite well. She thanked the 140 Labour MPs who voted for Trident for standing up for the national interest. She took quite a tough line on fiscal conservatism, saying he calls it austerity, I call it living within our means, which showed that although the surplus target's been abandoned as a matter of pragmatism, she's not resiling from the general Tory economic stance.
Right, so in terms of not resiling from that stance, what does that sort of mean for the pattern of politics over the next couple of years? What type of budget do we think is likely to come from Philip Hammond?
It's very hard to say, because Philip Hammond is not clearly in one ideological camp or another. The view of some on the Tory right has always been that post-Brexit, the UK will become a more free market economy, lower corporation tax. Of course, George Osborne has said it should go down to 15%, more deregulation, more foreign investment. And David Davis, actually, I spoke to him last night, has said, has guaranteed that workers' rights won't be eroded as a result of of Brexit. And so I think that there will be this tension between, on the one hand, the economic priorities of some Brexiteers who want a more free market model, and those of Theresa May, who's called for worker representation on company boards, stricter controls on foreign takeovers. And where Philip Hammond sits within that divide will be quite crucial.
Right. To move from one party to another, it feels likely that Jeremy Corbyn will be re-elected leader of the Labour Party. What's your sense for, where now for the PLP?
Yes, so the expectation, rightly, I think, of most Labour MPs is that he will win, and probably win by quite a large margin, perhaps even as great as his win last year. There's obviously, within the media, a lot of talk about split, a revival of the SDP scenario in 1981. Actually, among most MPs, including those who a successful split would depend on, there's much less of that. I think their hope is that they can narrow Corbyn's victory and come at him again. If that's not possible, then I think Labour will probably have to muddle along. And it may well be that it's the general electorate that takes Corbyn out before the Labour electorate does.
All right, I mean, just a question. I mean, if there is a snap election, which feels plausible, she has now sacked more ministers than her majority, what happens then? Does Corbyn step down if he loses? Or, you know, obviously if he's prime minister, it kind of fixes itself. But what's the sort of scenario if Labour are defeated in a snap election?
The convention would be that he departs at that point, particularly if Labour goes down to around 150 seats, as some MPs fear, which would be, I think, its worst result since 1935. But as we've seen, Jeremy Corbyn doesn't always follow convention. And he could well retain the support of the members. He could argue that he hasn't had a full term in the job. They could point to the precedent of Neil Kinnock, one of their old enemies, who was defeated in 1987, went on to fight and lose the 1992 general election. And given the current leadership system, as we've seen, you can lose the confidence of almost all of your MPs and still retain the backing of Labour members. What could force Jeremy Corbyn out at that point would be if he himself is exhausted by the job and no longer wants to do it, and we've had intermittent rumours that he's been close to stepping away, or if there's a schism within the Corbynites where some of his key backers say a new leader is needed.
Any chance of that, do you think, anytime soon?
No.
Right. Well, in that case, I guess we'll have a lot more TMQs to talk about.
So I've got a You Ask Us for our You Ask Us section. And of course, listeners, we love hearing from you. If you want to tweet us at Stephen KB or at Helen Lewis, or drop us an email. This one is really about future gazing, which you've got slightly more confidence about doing than I have, certainly, about what happens after a Corbyn win. You know, do we think there's going to be an early election? Do we think there'll be a Labour Party split? Do we think there'll be another leadership challenge? What's your feeling about what might happen at the end of the year?
I mean, my instinct isn't we will have an early election, if nothing else, because the economy globally and nationally is looking distinctly pre-recessional. Theresa May has sacked a fair whack of people.
So this is the idea that she's only got a majority of 12, effectively a working majority of 16, that she's kind of sacked more egos than she's kind of got as majority. So she could do with refilling the benches with more people. The thing is, right, and people talk about the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, so either that can be overturned, which is a no problem because the Tories have got an overall majority, or they can get a new election through with a two-thirds majority, and what Labour Party can go, actually, we'd really rather not now, and not look criminally weak. If Labour are on the kind of figures that we saw in that poll, I know that is a Theresa May bounce because she's just taken over. So Tories on 40 and Labour on 29.
Yeah.
And UKIP have dropped a few points as well. No sign of the Lib Dem surge.
Oh, no, actually, the Lib Dems are up a bit in that poll.
But it's a Lib Dem sort of squall, I guess. Yeah. That's pretty serious for Labour. But also, would it be career-ending for Corbyn?
No. My instinct, and again, if you are... if you are going to support Corbyn in this leadership election, and I have got your thinking vehemently wrong, do let me know. But my impression is that what will happen if there is a snap election and Labour go down to heavy defeat of the kind that poll would suggest, and indeed of the kind that every by-election, local election, you know, all suggest Labour on course to get a worse result than it did in 2015.
Which I think is difficult for people to understand, because a lot of people say to me, well, you know, they won the Tooting by-election, you won the mayoral race in Bristol, and then you have to go into a very boring explanation of saying, well, at this point in the electoral cycle, Ed Miliband was, what, 4 to 6 points ahead?
And he was 10 points ahead at this point. I mean, but also the thing is, it's not even about the polls, because there was always a strong indication that the polls last time were a bit skew-iff, because the Labour Party's performance in by-elections was never quite where it ought to have been, other than 2012. We kind of know then what happens in British politics is that people kind of go, oh, we don't really like the government, let's vote for the other guys in safe elections, by-elections, local elections. So there are two interesting subplots there. One is, thus far, the greater devolution of power doesn't appear to have started to lead to people treating local elections as not a referendum on the national government, with two exceptions, Wales and Scotland, where they've been devolved and with a fair whack of power for some time. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not London starts to go down that pattern, and whether or not, as the Northern Powerhouse and the Metro Mayors. But so far, in the local elections where you'd expect them to do well, Labour obviously lost seats. In by-elections, you know, kind of, you know, in the 1994 to 1997 days, Labour was getting kind of 30-point swings, which they very much did not get in
Tooting.
Plus,
the inherent problem with the mayors, so for example, Martin Rees in Bristol, is that the mayoralties, by definition, are being contested in large urban centres, which are good for Labour, good for Corbyn's Labour specifically, right?
Yeah, I think that's the other thing. It's just like, There are two problems. I mean, one, there's the problem that actually, even if you change the electoral system, there is no left-wing combination that gets you close to 50+1% of the vote, which is one of the many problems with the Progressive Alliance idea. The other problem is that we are in a proportional system. So under first past the post, if you are strongest in the inner cities, university towns, it's great for the ego of certain MPs. I mean, so, you know, one MP who is fairly critical of Corbyn but has kept their mouth firmly shut because they think he's going nowhere, you know, said to me, they said, well, to be honest, on paper, my seat is marginal, but, you know, I will lose a couple of thousand votes to UKIP, but I'll gain a lot more of that in the student areas, and I'll gain a lot more of that in the kind of, where the lecturers live. So they're sort of fine. So there are lots and lots of reasons to be very worried about what will happen when the Labour Party meets the electorate. But my instinct is, if it's a snap election, people will say it was the fault of the plotters, which obviously it doesn't help that the Labour Party is midway through a Labour leadership battle. He didn't get a fair whack. He didn't get a decent run of it. He should effectively get to serve a full term, as it were.
Kinnock.
Yeah, Kinnock will be the other president. Lost 87. Yeah, and so that's the other reason why I think it will be irresistible for Theresa May. Yeah, I mean, if the Conservatives cannot believe their luck, then they are going to get to fight a general election against Jeremy Corbyn once. The prize of getting to do it twice, I mean, you'd have to be crazy to pass it up. And it's there waiting for them. I mean, partly because, to be honest, and this is an, if by some miracle, Owen Smith somehow was able to overturn what looks like a fairly massive deficit in the poll, probably a fairly massive deficit among these registered supporters. Although, you know, for balance, it is worth noting that the only constituency Labour Party to issue a supporting nomination so far has done so for Owen Smith.
Which is Richmond, right? Which, yeah, I'm guessing is not massively represented. I think my problem is, I went back and I reread a Vice interview that was done with John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn just before the last election this morning. And, it, you know, they talk very explicitly in that one, you know, when they had absolutely, they were still just members of the campaign group of, you know, left-wing Labour MPs who felt very much shut out from the top of the Labour Party about not, you know, not feeling that parliamentary representation was really the be-all and end-all, and actually about wanting to build a movement and a group. And I think this is the fundamental clash for me, is that their ambitions are not necessarily parliamentary, and their leading MPs, whose ambitions are parliamentary. And I think I actually almost find it quite sad, because I feel as though if Corbyn were leading a movement, you know, if he were leading an extra parliamentary movement, I'd find him a lot more appealing than I do as leader of the Labour Party.
Yeah, I mean, because the interesting thing is basically what is happening throughout Europe, and to a lesser extent, to be honest with Saunders, but I know that many of our listeners, like most of the British political class, are obsessed with the state, so I'm going to mention Saunders as well, he said peevishly, is that you have an insurgent left-wing party which is taking a great number of votes from the left, but also from other places. But it has knackered the traditional Social Democratic Party. We've seen it with Die Linke in Germany, although obviously they are now in a fairly recessional state. We've seen it most recently with Podemos and the PSOE in Spain. And the place where that bit of the left has been incredibly successful is Greece, where Syriza has not just, has supplanted, has become the government, effectively has eaten the traditional left-wing party in PASOK. What first past the post means is that is happening inside the walls of the existing Social Democratic Party. And understandably, traditional Social Democrats are not happy about it.
Yeah.
It's not how they think politics should be. The interesting question is whether or not the insurgent left party would do better without the branding of the Labour Party, whether or not actually, if Momentum was standing against Labour in seats, it would do better. It might do differently badly. It's sort of hard to tell.
I don't know. I feel like all the way through, and I think this applies to Europe, well, with the exception of Greece, that has exceptional economic circumstances, I think probably rule it out of this. You have a much smaller but energised radical left party, right? And I think that's the problem for social democracy. Is the same thing was the problem with the EU, right? It was lots of people thought it was very sensible, but no one felt really passionate about it, at least before the EU referendum. I think a few people have woken up to it now. I don't think I can see anyone getting passionate about Owen Smith and what he represents, in the way that they do about Jeremy Corbyn. And that's the problem. It's the kind of enthusiasm gap, right? It's the kind of, you know, that you should eat an apple, but actually what you really want is a Twix.
But the thing is, so people got very passionate. I mean, obviously he's now got some slight problems with the Italian banking sector and etc. So Matteo Renzi, it turns out, is literally a scale model of New Labour. To condense down to 4 years, you have the bit where it's like, I'm a reforming new type of politician, everyone gets excited. Then you have a banking crisis and it all goes horribly wrong, but they've squeezed it down into 4 years. But, Renzi, a moderate social democrat, great one-liners, wonderful hair. I love every tradition of this part of the left, other than of losing. Has got people to be genuinely passionate about him. I do think, so obviously, there are genuine problems for social democracy, not least the fact that it has always struggled in Europe as effectively a political option of good times, and then people see it as the charity standing order that they cancel the minute things get tough. But the other thing is, I mean, Owen Smith's a bit crap, isn't he?
Within the safety of the podcast, I can say that he hasn't wowed me so far. I don't think that's... I think that's a problem. And I think that vote for the least worst guy is in no one's idea of a brilliant rallying call.
I mean, I think the thing is, so obviously I find it persuasive because I look at the polling, I look at the local elections, and I basically think that if Corbyn leads Labour into the 2020 election, it will write off the 2025 election for sure, and it may well write off Labour as a party of government. But if you aren't convinced of that, if you even only think that Jeremy Corbyn will simply lose the 2020 election, what is...
Yeah, I do hear that a lot from people who support Corbyn, who I think if there was somebody that they felt was a ready-baked package that would win, they would say, okay, well, obviously this isn't the right person, we need to lobby them on X, Y, and Z. But you can't say Jeremy Corbyn is unelectable and then present us with someone else that we don't think looks particularly electable either. If we're going to be, you know, if we're going to lose, we want to lose while feeling good about ourselves and feeling that the party's in a place that, you know, we'd ideally want it to be. Anyway, that was that was depressing, but I don't think it's going to get any chirpier over the summer, is it, Stephen?
Did we actually answer the question of what happens when he wins?
I think there's a lot of rending of garments, gnashing of teeth. I don't think there'll be an immediate challenge to him again now. It seems to me that there might be a sort of zombie PLP state where people stagger on for a bit. I mean, he's been talking about extending the hand of friendship and people coming back into the shadow cabinet. There's two reasons I don't believe that. First of all is, how do you do your first TV interview where they say to you, so Chris Bryant, you said that he was terrible, what do you think, what changed your mind? And there's no plausible answer to that apart from, I'm grimly here, sticking it out. And the second thing is, it's not a great reward to the loyalists, to the very few loyalists, right? To your Rebecca Long Baileys and your Kat Smiths and all that kind of stuff, that you would say, well, you know, thanks for stepping into the shadow cabinet at a time when I was incredibly unpopular in the PLP and all the kind of grimness that you'll have got in the tea room and about that, but actually, you know, I'm sorry, Kurt, you know, I actually really want to give Tristram Hunt your job now.
Yeah, I also think, like,
you just can't do that to people.
That, you know, the other interesting subplot of all of this is, if you notice the way that the policy platform is subtly shifting, so things like support for High Speed 2, right? Now, Lillian Greenwood, probably one of the people who's thought most keenly about transport policy in the Labour Party, one of Corbyn's best decisions was to promote her, mystifying to me why Ed Miliband gave that job to Michael Duggar instead of her in the first place. But, you know, very, very good at it. Pro High Speed 2, had a lot of clashes she kept very quiet about because she's very much not someone who briefs against people, until she quit and went, look, this is one of the big problems. And immediately, you have John Trickett going, oh, actually, maybe I'm going to say, maybe I've got some objections to where the route is going. At that point, from the loyalist perspective, why would you want to share, to retake on the policy concessions you had for the first 9 months? He didn't buy them very much. At that point, yeah, they might as well, you know, go for the kind of maximalist offer, you know, to do that thing I hate and quote the West Wing, let Corbyn be Corbyn.
I watched that episode 2 nights ago and Leo writes it on the napkin and you're just like, oh. Little did you know when you filmed this episode that you were ruining British politics for 10 years to come. Well, that's a nice note to end on. Yeah, do tweet us or email us with your questions and we have plenty of time to answer them over the summer. What fun it was.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Will be. And finally, it is plug time. Stephen and I will be appearing live, plus special guests, on the, it's the first day of Labour conference, actually, so you can come down before getting the train up to Liverpool. That is Sunday the 25th of September from 1:30 at King's Place for the London Podcast Festival, and we will be appearing live. Tickets are available from King's Place via their website, or Stephen and I will both tweet some links in the coming days. Yeah. Be there or miss my version of Hamilton rewritten to be about the Tory leadership contest.
Yeah, it's an exciting time. You have the opportunity to see me in the company of another spirit-sapping liberal, Nick Clegg, on...
Now Lib Dem King of Brexit. Now Lib Dem, so you'll be able to talk about Europe with him. That'd be nice.
This next Tuesday, that's Tuesday the 26th of July, if you go to www.newstatesman.com/events, you will see Troubled Waters, Stephen Bush and Nick Clegg in conversation on post-Brexit Britain. But yeah, do come along. It'll be great fun.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.